The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
We're in a situation where we have put together, and you guys did it for our administration, the President Obama's administration before this. We have put together, I think, the most extensive and inclusive voter fraud organization in the history of American politics.
People would ask me, knowing what you know now, do you wish like you had a third term? And I used to say, you know what, if I could make an arrangement where I had a stand-in, a front man or front woman, and they had an earpiece in, and I was just in my basement in my sweats, looking through the stuff, and then I could sort of deliver the lines, but somebody else was doing all the talking and ceremony, I'd be fine with that, because I found the work fascinating.
It is a scandal.
Yes.
It is without question, and maybe even worse than Watergate in some ways.
Right.
Because Richard Nixon was in control of his faculties when he wasn't drinking.
Do you feel that you owe the American people an apology for slightly dropping the ball with this, and not just to Lara Trump?
I feel like I owe the American people an acknowledgement that I wish I had covered the story better.
Carefully worded apology there from Jake Tapper. He came out with the big reveal, which basically said that he was covering it up for 4 years. This presidency where the mental faculties just weren't functioning. I mean, what a scandal, worse than Watergate. It's all coming into the furious light of day, isn't it? The truth. It is. And we were, those two clips, we played those over and again. They're probably the two most played clips. Biden saying, we've set up this voter fraud organization. And then Obama, for his part, just after they stole the election, saying, you know what, I'd like to run things again for a third term from the basement. And that's exactly what happened. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. You can get to the live video stream of this program at trumpetdaily.com or at the Rumble channel. Just go to rumble.com/Trumpet Daily and make sure you leave us the thumbs up and a nice comment down below. We enjoy the feedback. We'll get to some of our email feedback one of these days, td@thetrumpet.com. Today, we continue. Some of you might have thought that the interview with Melanie Phillips ended at the end of yesterday's show, but actually we sat down for quite a long period of time and had a long discussion, and we've split it up into three parts. So today, for the second half of the show, you'll get part two in our exclusive interview with conservative author Melanie Phillips. I thought, following yesterday's segment, by the way, with her, this came out in the Jerusalem Post just today. This is the editorial board at the JP, where it says, after 600 days, it's clear that the likelihood of the remaining hostages being rescued in an IDF operation is virtually nil. The increased military incursion into Gaza, the government hopes, will exert further pressure on Hamas. It says further, with the greatest gratitude toward the U.S., both under Joe Biden and Trump, for their efforts to bring the hostages home, it's time to stop these plans and negotiations and move to the end game. And so what is the end game for Israel? This is the Jerusalem Post. This is one of the more conservative outlets in Israel. It says, after 600 days, the hostages are out of time, and the nation, torn apart by the war, is out of time and out of energy. We're tired of fighting. Remember that statement from decades ago? Ehud Olmert, I think it was. We're tired. We're out of energy. Israel has devastated Hamas and destroyed Gaza in the process. Military experts say that Hamas will not pose a lethal threat to Israel for a long time to come. Translation, we'll go ahead and let Hamas survive. We just have to get the hostages back. That's all. I mean, that's the end game. This is just another way of saying we surrender. And we'll let Hamas survive this. It says, after 600 days, we need to end the war and withdraw from Gaza in exchange for the 58 hostages. Those are the only negotiations that should be taking place. It's in Hamas's interest and it's in Israel's interest. It goes on and talks about how that the threat coming from Hamas, you know, it can't just reemerge in the next few weeks or months. It's going to be down the road, but, you know, we'll deal with it then. And so yet another sad and painful chapter to watch play out in this ongoing war to obliterate the Jews. I mean, the genocide is only going in one direction here. I saw a tweet where it said if all that Hamas or the Palestinians had to do to survive, to not be killed, was to not go after and murder Jews. If that's all they have to do, they just put down their weapons. And everybody's happy, theoretically. But what happens if Israel puts down its weapons? Well, you get October 7 after October 7 after October 7. Melanie Phillips, in that segment we had yesterday, notice what she had to say about why Hamas took those hostages on October 7, why they took them in the first place. Play clip 13.
Hamas took the hostages for one reason only, that they knew that this was the ultimate weapon which would enable them to ensure that Israel did not ultimately defeat them. Because ultimately they held the, if I can use the metaphor now, the phrase, they held the trump card, which was the hostages. Israel would, you know, go to great lengths, to put it mildly, to not have them harmed. And the negotiations were, in my view, a farce, because America was negotiating with Qatar, as if Qatar was an honest broker in this, as if it was an independent interlocutor. It's not. Qatar is, to all intents and purposes, Hamas.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, that's yesterday on the show. And then today you have this shameful editorial in the Jerusalem Post that basically calls for Israel to surrender. This is the leading English daily newspaper in Israel. And their editorial board says, you know what? Let's just try to get the hostages back, withdraw from Gaza, let Hamas survive, and everyone moves on. Well, 600 days ago, remember, Israel vowed to destroy Hamas. This only puts Prime Minister Netanyahu in an even more difficult position to win this war. Not surrender, win. You just see the spirit of surrender all over in Israelite nations today. And in a lot of ways, that's what Melanie Phillips' book is about, the one that she released just this year. We talked about it at length in our interview. So you can look forward to segment two of our interview with Melanie Phillips coming up in the last half of the program. But just going back to the election steal, you know, Biden saying, yeah, we've set up this voter fraud organization. That, you know, the Biden that didn't have his mental faculties there, he said the quiet part out loud. And then Obama, he said the quiet part out loud to the funny man. And it's so obvious now what happened. And we were playing these clips over and over and over again. They needed someone who wasn't all there mentally. The dear leader did. Just put him in as a puppet. It doesn't matter if he's brain dead or not. Just put him in as a puppet and I'll run the show. And then, of course, they had COVID as the perfect cover. He has to stay in the basement. You know, we've got to socially distance. And they also had COVID as perfect cover for the steal, the election steal, the ballot harvesting, and so on. A perfect plan. And they carried it out perfectly. I mean, look at what they did. Look at what, I mean, the reason they're talking about the scandal, at least conservatives, being worse than Watergate is because we've had 4 years of bitter affliction because of this fraud. That's what it amounts to. This was from Jesse Waters last night, clip one.
So the conspiracy that Biden wasn't running the country wasn't a conspiracy. It was their strategy. It's all coming out. Democrats wanted a brain-dead president with a shadow government and campaigned on saving democracy. If Joe had somehow won, unknown Biden handlers would have run the country. They would have controlled the Situation Room while Biden was taking a nap. Unnamed Biden aides say this: Biden just had to win, and then he could disappear for 4 years. He'd only have to show proof of life every once in a while. His aides could pick up the slack. And they just told you Trump was Hitler to justify beating him by any means necessary. That means lying to you, arresting him, maybe even shooting him. Because if they covered up Biden, why wouldn't they cover up Butler?
They covered up everything. It's amazing still, even. You know, he talked about the many other areas where they lied, you know, the Wuhan lab and on it goes. But still you have conservatives that just, you know, they steer clear of the election steal. That's the biggest cover up and lie of all. And that's what you got on this program from day one. As soon as the regime media anointed Joe Biden as the fake president of the United States, I mean, you heard it here on this show nonstop. As I said, we played those clips in the cold open over and over again. They said it. They said it out loud, whether Biden's was a mistake or not. They said the quiet part out loud. And now, like Jesse says there, I mean, it's all coming out. It's all being made known. God is exposing it. They had this as their plan all along. Put basement Biden in as the candidate. Rarely let him come out for interviews. And they were able to, Jake Tapper and company were able to cover it up right up until June 27 last year when they had the debate debacle. And then on a dime, you heard it. We played it on the program the next day following that debate. They all threw Biden under the bus. They rode him as far as they could. And then it went from that to Kamala and all those things. You know the story. But it's all coming out in the open. The truth. The truth is being exposed. And so are the lies. So is the deception. Listen to what Jesse Waters had to say about Jake Tapper coming out with this kind of a half-hearted, very legalistic apology. This is moving ahead to clip four.
Tapper is saying the public knew the news before he did. Journalists can't be the last ones to know the scandal. That means they're not a journalist. Tapper should resign. If you missed Bidengate or you covered it up, what else did you miss? What else did you cover up? The border? Epstein? The lab leak? Democrats are like the suspect that goes, yep, officer, you got me, I did it, and thinks he's just confessing to a single crime. And there's like a dozen other crimes with his fingerprints all over them that detectives can easily connect to him. Politicians lie, right, Tapper? So the Afghan pullout wasn't Trump's fault. The Democrats probably were just importing new voters over the border. And maybe Trump didn't sleep with Stormy. This is only the beginning. The FBI is opening up an investigation into the cover-ups of the White House cocaine, the DNC pipe bomb, and the Supreme Court abortion leaks. The last 4 years, one big cover-up.
He's right about that. And the biggest cover-up of all, the fact that they stole the election, the fact that they had this puppet in place that had no business being in the Oval Office, but they manufactured enough fake votes for him to beat Donald Trump. And for 4 years, we were telling you about the steal, and we were telling you that Donald Trump was coming back. We told you that God would bring him back. That only by the hand of God would this course correct. Of course, there's other problems that America is facing, and we'll have to get to those as the week or into next week even. We're running a little short on time this week just because of the special interviews we've had and so on. But what a scandal. And it's all coming out into the open, isn't it? This was over at Fox, I think Fox News as well, actually, as they talked about why this is worse than Watergate, clip 8.
Emily, here's why I agree this could be worse than Watergate. You know, I've been pulling out the policy implications of Biden's decision making. And, you know, here on Outnumbered, we talked about on immigration. Senator Bennett left a meeting with him and said, we're in trouble. A cabinet secretary said we could have used a 20 years younger Joe Biden on the issue of immigration. You had Senator Warner leaving a phone call with him after releasing 11 detainees from Guantanamo and saying clearly he was not up to speed and wondered if it was connected to his age. These are policy decisions that an incapacitated president could have affected. I agree. This could be far worse than Watergate.
And we also know the disastrous and fatal results of his botched policy decisions, right? We have the 13 service members from the botched pullout of Afghanistan. We have the reports of surface-to-air missiles in the hands of terrorists in this country because of the open southern border. There's not enough time in the hour to list the known policy consequences and the unknown but predictable consequences based on that. So, yes, I agree with Jake Tapper that, of course, it's worse than Watergate because we all had to suffocate under it for 4 years.
I mean, even Jake Tapper is saying this now. Of course, Fox News agrees. It's worse, far worse, as one of them said. An incapacitated president? How did an incapacitated president get installed as president of the United States? How did this happen? Well, if you're going to go back to root causes, you go right back to the dear leader and the election steal. And then the fundamental transformation that just continued through the years of this fake presidency. I mean, I know it seems in some ways it seems like ancient history now. But as we told you all along, you can see it in America Under Attack. One reason God allowed the steal to happen was to expose the evil, the lawlessness, to expose the fundamental transformation. It's worse because of all of these policy decisions, the policy decisions of the dear leader, as he worked from the basement, speaking into the earpiece. Like I say, they get right close to the root cause and then skip right over the election steal. Why? It's so obvious. You put it together. Like I said, COVID. What a crazy year. The summer of love as they suspended all of the COVID protocols for 3 months so that left-wing rioters could kill people. And then we're right back into everything's perfect. Yeah, the election was perfect. Everything was abnormal. Everything was lawless. Everything was covered up. And now it's been exposed. And now you've got NBC writing about how, yeah, Obama and his people, they've lost their shine. People aren't swooning like they used to. We'll get to that. Maybe not today. As I look at the clock, we might have to come back to this tomorrow. But to just direct your focus to America Under Attack, we advertise this book right here, probably more than any other piece of literature over the last 4 years, because that's what this was, an attack by an Antiochus figure, as he's mentioned in the Bible. And what a destructive attack it was. We use the word destroy, I think, 87 times. In America Under Attack, and that was Obama's goal, I mean, it sounds nice with fundamental transformation, but just think about that for a moment. He's coming in 2008 or 2009, and he's talking about fundamentally transforming America into what? My father writes, the destructive trends of the Obama years were far more dangerous than most people realized at the time. People were naive and ignorant about the extent of the threat. Even most Republican leaders failed to realize what they were dealing with. People committed to destroying the government of this land. And Herbert Armstrong was writing about this back in the 1950s. You can see that, and he was right. We were witnessing a government and a nation on the verge of collapse. I mean, and that's what you heard there in that Fox News clip. Yeah, I think it's the worst, far worse than the scandal from the 1970s. Because look at all of these policies. Look at the southern border. Look at the sickness. Basically, that's what they're saying. Look at the sickness. Look at the affliction. It refers to 2 Kings 14, the bitter affliction. My father said this in an article from March 2020. So this is right after they installed the fake president. Mentally incapacitated. I mean, those are the words of the commentators now. Even Jake Tapper. It says, Democrats have taken to heart Barack Obama's pledge to fundamentally transform America. And look at the ways they want to transform it. They want to tear down America's history, America's constitution, America's moral standards, America's freedoms. They want to redistribute the nation's prosperity. He refers to the fundamental transformation. And he says these officials have relied on the media to spread this information, and the mainstream media have been shamefully complicit. They too want to do all they can to overthrow the government. That's been the goal from the moment Donald Trump got elected. That's treason. That's my father writing in 2020. And it's spot on. It was spot on then, and it's spot on today. Tomorrow's News Today. That's what you get in America Under Attack when it first came out. That's what you get in the Trumpet Magazine. If you don't have a subscription to the Trumpet Magazine, make sure that you call our operators today and request your free one-year subscription. God's truth, Bible prophecy, the sure word of prophecy. I mean, it gives us so many wonderful and precious insights into what is happening today, why it's happening, and where it is leading. We're going to have to cut it off there, break away to a short promo, and when we come back, we'll finish today's show with segment two of our three-part series with Melanie Phillips. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We'll be right back.
Daily news, Bible prophecy. See the connection on the Trumpet Daily. Are you feeling overwhelmed by the flood of news and information? You need something to sift the news and bring you only what matters most. You need the Trumpet Daily. You also need something to help you understand not just what's happening now, but what will happen next. You need the Trumpet Daily. Only the Trumpet Daily accurately matches daily news to precise Bible prophecies. Because Bible prophecy is the only tool up to the task of sifting the news down to what's important and showing you what will happen next. Join host Stephen Fleury every weekday. Go to trumpetdaily.com.
Yeah, one thing we point out on this program often is it's in the Gospels, the verse that talks about judging by fruits and not just, you know, going by the words that are said. And that's why we, you know, when we hear these statements made about the Syrian leader or Qatar or, you know, just terrorists in general, Vladimir Putin, as I said earlier, we're just kind of stunned that people would just take, like Steve Witkoff, you mentioned earlier, just take a statement from one of these tyrants or dictators and think that, well, there's a deal to be made here then. Or as you said, you know, anything can be I think you said it in one of your columns, anything can be solved with money, you know, and everyone's happy. But I think one thing that you bring out in your book that was really, really amazing is just when you were talking about human nature and this idea that, you know, everyone can be trusted. And I mean, I think it's early on in your book, and you were basically saying that no, you especially when they're in nations that aren't brought up under the Judeo-Christian ethic and you know, system of morality, and of course that's what you're saying in your book is crumbling even in our nations, but then if it's another nation with a radical ideology, I mean, you can't. I think it was General Flynn last week who said, you know, the moment Iran signs a peace agreement, you know, they'll violate it the very next day. That's just what they've done. So last week you had another column, powerful column on blood on their hands. This was following the murder of the two Israeli embassy, the young people there, the Jews in Washington, D.C. I mean, terrorism happening right in the backyard of the White House. I read one commentary that said, you know, this hopefully will be a wake up call. And as I said on my program, it October 7 wasn't even a wake up call, not the way that it should have been for the West.
Right.
And so
right.
Here these two Jews are murdered, you know, and it's in the news cycle for a day or two. And then it's just, you know, it's quickly forgotten. And you said, and you went through the history, the recent history, and all the propaganda, you know, 14,000 Palestinian babies are going to die in 2 days, and how that the media is just out there promoting these lies. And then, of course, following October 7, all of the pro-Hamas demonstrations around the world, and people aren't held to account. And there is blood on their hands. If you could maybe just elaborate on how that the murder of those two young people last week impacted you and led into that that powerful column.
Yeah, well, I mean, the alleged murderer shouted free, free Palestine. And I did this for Gaza. And so people put two and two together and made the correct assumption that he had been radicalized, if I can use that word, be radicalized to basically want to murder people. He'd been radicalized by the rubbish that we've heard on the streets for the last 19 months, on campus, in demonstrations, in which Israel is painted as the aggressor in the region, as the committer of war crimes, as the perpetrators of genocide, whereas in fact Israel is not only innocent of those things, not only going to enormous lengths to preserve the civilian lives in Gaza as far as it can, but is actually the victim of those things. It's the victim of an attempted genocide. It's the victim of war crimes. And so this is, to put it mildly, perverse. And we've now seen what free Palestine actually means. It does not mean supporting the oppressed Palestinians, the so-called oppressed Palestinian Arabs of Gaza. It does not even mean being anti-Israel. Free Gaza means the murder of people assumed to be Jews. I say assumed because I think one of these two victims was actually a Christian. But basically, they were both working at the Israel embassy in Washington, D.C., and they both had committed their lives to the Jewish project of the State of Israel, and so they were singled out. You know, they were killed because they were part of a mindset in this young murderer who saw a Jewish event. It was at the Jewish Museum, involving Jews, and he wanted those Jews to be killed. So. There was a direct connection between what he was screaming as Free Palestine and the killing of Jews. And what I think is that this is a very important connection to make, because the cause by which under which all these people are demonstrating on the streets and on campus represents something much more than just the issue that's that they purport to be demonstrating about. What I've said in my book is that October 7, the atrocities of October 7, 2023, threw down a kind of challenge to the West. Do you support civilization or do you support barbarism? And unfortunately, the West has shown ever since that it does not support civilization. I mean, here you had, you know, a genocidal attack, unbelievably barbarous. It wasn't just it wasn't just killing people. It was a savage and depraved slaughter involving, as we know, not just murder, but rape and beheadings and burning people alive and murdering children in front of their parents and so on. And you would expect that the civilized world would have said, well, obviously, Israel has to do whatever it takes right. to stop this, because these people who've done this are threatening to do it again and again until the state of Israel is eliminated, until every Jew is killed, and then they're going to come after the West. Then they say so. They're going to come after America. They're going to come after the West. They're going to come after the Christian world. They say so in turns. But instead of taking that view, the West turned against Israel, blamed it for effectively its own slaughter, accused it of crimes of which it was innocent and the victim, and so on and so forth. And what my book is saying is this, that in order to understand this appalling reaction to October 7 by the West, one has to understand what the West has done to itself. And in order to understand what the West has done to itself, one has to understand that the West is at war with the Jewish people and Judaism. For this reason, as I say in my book, and as I've written for decades, the West's elites, its intelligentsia, the people who run the culture, have basically taken a wrecking ball to Western civilization and the Western nation and its core values on the basis that the West is fundamentally bad because it was born in the original sins of colonialism and imperialism and racism and all that sort of stuff. And so you have to basically demolish it and replace it by something better, which is universalism, brotherhood of man, transnational institutions. So I've been writing for years about the onslaught on the traditional family, the onslaught on education as the transmission of a culture, the onslaught on the very idea of the nation, the elevation of universalist values through transnational institutions, and so on. And at the root of that onslaught on the West is the onslaught on its core values. Its core values, as we know, are largely implanted in the West by Christianity, the foundational creed of the West. Okay, the Greeks had quite a lot of input as well, but nevertheless, Christianity is the foundational creed of the West. And Christianity itself didn't come from nowhere. Its parent is Judaism. And the values that everybody in the West holds dear or purports to hold dear, whether they are religious people, whether they are people of no faith, they are biblical values. And so the West's onslaught on itself has been, in effect, an onslaught on biblical values. I've said in the book at great length that few people understand the immense importance of those values of the Hebrew Bible to the West civilization and greatness. Few understand how extensive that influence has been and how important it is and has been to the greatness of the West. And so it's not surprising that a civilization, a society, a culture, the West, which is turned on itself, has turned on the Jews, the ultimate architects or the creators, the inspirers of its core values. And it's turned on the Jews both through the State of Israel and through its onslaught on Jews as people, through this tsunami of Jew hatred that we're seeing throughout the West. And what I say in my book is this, that this has brought the West to a parlous situation in which it's kind of teetering on the edge of the cultural cliff. And there are many people who think that, you know, it's not going to survive. It's created a kind of vacuum. It doesn't know what its identity is anymore. It's tried to destroy it. It's no longer prepared to fight and die for it. And into that vacuum have come predatory Islamists, people who understand that without the scaffolding of a religion at its core, a society does not cannot exist anymore, is vulnerable. And so they've marched in through both terrorism, threats, subversion of the democratic process, having lots of babies. It's a strategy, take over the West. So many people in the West think, well, it's all over. We can't survive this. It's finished. The West is finished. And I'm saying in the book, no, actually, no. It could be. I don't know whether the West even wants to survive. And can it pull itself on the brink, back from the brink like this? After all it's done to itself, I'm not sure. But if it wants to survive, I think it has a very good shot. But it has to do two things. It has to learn to love itself as a culture. It has to learn to celebrate what it is. It has to understand the part played in it by Christianity. It has to return to those biblical values. It has to uphold them and understand that it's adopted ideologies which have undermined those biblical values. And it has to learn to love the people who are at the very heart of those biblical values, the Jews, for two reasons. The Jews do cultural survival. It's their unique selling point. They have survived everything that's ever been thrown at them. And they can tell the West how you do cultural survival, how you keep the cultural show on the road. The Jews know that better than anybody. They have a lot of very practical, useful guidance to impart. And at the same time, it's by no coincidence that the values of the Jews are indeed the values of the West. And if those two things are understood and the West comes to love the Jews instead of disdaining them and wanting to eradicate their unique qualities and the unique contribution they've made to the West, if the West comes to love the Jews instead and listen to them, then I think that the West can indeed be saved. And what I'm saying in my final chapter is that I hope that there would be what I call a countercultural resistance movement growing, a kind of coalition of everybody from every conceivable creed and culture and ethnicity and group, women and men, left and right, black and white, gays and straights, one religion after, you know, all people of all religions, including Islam, Muslims. There are plenty of Muslims who want the West to continue and understand it. People of all religions and people of no religion, all combining in a kind of coalition, which I think should be led by Jews and Christians, because these are the foundational creeds of the West. There should be this coalition of people who want the West to survive, understand that its values are not universal. They are particular to it. They are particular to it because they're founded essentially in the Bible, and will do what needs to be done to pull it back, which I think could be done if the will was there and if the leadership was there. That's basically what my book's about.
Yeah. We produced a booklet, just a short little booklet, 20, 25 years ago, but it just went through all the founders of the United States and many that were involved in, you know, writing the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. And all of them, for the most part, maybe I can't say all, but even the ones that weren't very religious said that religion and morality is that's going to be how this experiment, you know, lives long. If you get away from those foundational underpinnings,
exactly,
then you have really no. Well, like you say in your book, if it does come down to an aggressive, you know, enemy nation, you have to have something that you believe in and are willing to fight for. But if that's stripped away, then you know, no one's going to take to the battlefield to defend, you know, those core values of the West.
Precisely. And I'm afraid the West doesn't understand this, or rather its intelligentsia doesn't understand it.
Yeah.
I think there are millions and millions of ordinary people who find themselves abandoned by their political establishment, just as we were discussing earlier, because their political establishment is run by the intelligentsia, basically, the people who run the culture. And they've turned against it. They don't understand what it is. They don't understand what civilization is. They don't understand the West invented it. You know, it's not just Western civilization as an adjective. The West invented what we call civilized values, and that's because they were values that came from the Bible. People either don't know that, or they deny it, or they don't want to know it. But it is essential, if the West is to survive, that is acknowledged and built upon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're I guess some of the stuff you had at the start of your book, you kind of just summarized it there really, really well. But the point about you know, the nature or the heart of man, as the Bible talks about. You said, I think this is on page 28, the notion that human beings are somehow hardwired to be fair, compassionate, and empathetic, to seek cooperation rather than conquest, and to respect human life has been repeatedly shown to be false in cultures where these values are unknown. And what you're saying there is that we have to be taught these values, and that these values are taught in the Holy Scriptures, whether the Old Testament or the New, I believe. So, going back to the judging by fruits concept, the fact that we're so willing to just take what, you know, someone that really says openly, as you said earlier, you know, I want to destroy these people from the river to the sea, you know, free Palestine and so on, then go after the great Satan and so on. What is it like regarding Steve Witkoff and just so many of the nice things that he said as he's traveled through the Middle East about terrorists? I think you said recently when he made the comments, or maybe it was President Trump, I forget who, but the new leader in Syria, I forget his name, but he's Al-Qaeda through and through. But you said, you know, he doesn't just change his nature by trimming his beard and putting on a nice suit. Another column recently said that we're basically dealing with jihadists in suits, you know, when we're talking with all of the leaders of Qatar and so on. What was your take on, because he kind of came out of nowhere, at least from my perspective, but now, I mean, you almost hear about Steve Witkoff with respect to foreign policy and diplomacy, certainly within the Middle East, more than you even hear of Secretary Rubio. I mean, that seems to be President Trump's point man. So how has your take, did you know much about this man's background before he came in? I mean, you mentioned the ties that he had business-wise with Qatar. But what do you make of his traveling the region and some of the statements he's made about those that don't like Israel very much and that have historically been enemies of the United States, too?
Oh, well, it's very, very alarming because he seems not to understand the first thing about what he's dealing with. Put aside, you know, his financial ties to Qatar and so on. I think what he's demonstrating is the sort of great fallacy of the West. I mean, you talk about, you know, the outreach to the new Syrian guy, al-Sharaa, if that's his name. I mean, the idea that you could be a reformed Islamist is ridiculous, because it requires you to believe that on one day, when he was an Islamist fanatic, he believed that he had a sacred duty. He was enjoined by God to destroy the non-Islamic world. Sacred duty. And then the next day, apparently, he stopped having that sacred duty. I mean, if you believe it's a sacred duty, you don't suddenly... What are we all supposed to think, that he lost his faith? It's unlikely. It's much more likely that he is extremely shrewd and is playing a long game, hence the trimmed beard and the suit and so on. Now, when it comes to Mr. Witkoff, and he's not alone in this, I would say there are so many people in the West who think like this. They assume that, first of all, that values are universal, as you said before, that the things that we hold to be civilized in the West are universal, that they're universally understood and demanded by everybody else. You know, the rule of law, the respect for every human life, equality for women, and all that kind of stuff. This is universal. It's nonsense. It's particular to the West. But the West believes, or certain people in the West, certainly the intelligentsia, certainly people on the left, liberals, believe that everyone in the world is like them. It's so arrogant. It's so unbelievably arrogant. They believe that everybody is like them. In other words, everybody is just like they are, they think themselves, governed by reason and rationality and self-interest. And so everyone is susceptible to appeals to reason and to self-interest. You can basically buy anybody. And this is why President Trump's leitmotif of the art of the deal, followed by, I'm sure, Mr. Witkoff, lines them up absolutely with people on the left. People on the left believe that everything is a matter of negotiation. Every conflict is a matter of negotiation and compromise, because basically everyone is rational. Everyone is governed by self-interest. And so, you know, all you have to do is put people in the room, bash their heads together with enough inducements and enough threats, and they're rational. They're self-interested. They will do the deal in their own interest because they're rational. That's what the left thinks. That's why you have negotiations, peace processes, conflict resolution. Mrs. Trump and Witkoff don't think that. They don't have leftist thinking like that. But they do believe in the art of the deal. They do believe that everything is a potential deal. They also believe, therefore, that everybody in the world is governed by self-interest and therefore reason and rationality. And so when they look at Iran, they look at Mr. al-Sharaa in Syria, they look at the Ayatollahs in Iran, they're looking at people who believe implacably they have a sacred duty to God to murder a vast number of people, to destroy the non-Islamic world. And they're looking at these people and they don't understand that. They can't get their heads around that. They do not understand what a religious fanatic is, because in their world, everything is a potential deal. Everybody is a potential deal maker, because everybody, including the Ayatollahs of Iran, including Mr. al-Sharaa in Syria, everybody is governed by self-interest. So they end up in exactly the same position as their foes on the left. And it's nonsense. It's beyond nonsense. It's so lethally destructive, and it produces war, because and it produces war on the terms laid down by the warmongers, by the Islamic fanatics, because the West doesn't understand what it's dealing with. It denies all the time what it's dealing with. This is so fundamental to what's gone wrong, both in terms of what's happening internally in Britain, in America, faced with, you know, an Islamist push to Islamize the West. The West says, no, people aren't like that. They're all rational and self-interested, and why on earth would they behave like that? Because they don't understand what it is to be a religious fanatic. And this is influencing both the internal rot within the West and the external inability to properly confront the dangers that threaten it from outside.
Yeah. I some time ago, this is a month or two ago, Steve Witkoff sat down with Tucker Carlson. I think it's clip one. They were talking about the leader of Syria and how that he's a changed man. Listen to this exchange, clip one.
I think we'll prove that they won't be an existential risk either. But if we can get these terrorist organizations eliminated as risks, not existential, but still risks, they're destabilizing risks, then we'll normalize everywhere. I think Lebanon could normalize with Israel, literally. Normalize meaning a peace treaty with the two countries. That's really possible. Syria too. The indications are that Jelani is a different person than he once was, and people do change. You at 55 are completely different than how you were at 35.
That's for
and
sure.
And I say to myself, I'm a different person today at 68 years old. I'm not the person I knew 30 years ago. So maybe Jelani in Syria is a different guy.
So he's a different guy. He's a changed man. And I noted on my show the other day how it was in the same interview that that Witkoff said that one reason they're having these breakthrough conversations with Qatar and UAE and Saudi Arabia is because they're young people and they don't have those old sensibilities. So as I said on the show, I mean, which is it? You know, do we get to be 55 and we're a changed man and we're no longer a hardened terrorist or a religious fanatic? Or do we need to work with the young people who don't have all of those old sensibilities that their parents had or their grandparents had? So maybe you could comment on just going back to the religious fanaticism and ideology. You know, young people today, I mean, in the West, there's a steady diet of propaganda that they're getting on university campuses and so on. But how religious and fanatical do you feel the young generation in the Islamic world is or has been, let's say, in recent years?
Well, first of all, people do change. That is perfectly true. And people who have signed up in the past, in their youth, for a fanatical view of religion do change, but that follows from their losing their faith. You know, they don't retain the same faith and then kind of deny an important part of what was their faith. So that's why that's so ridiculous. As far as young people are concerned, if you're talking about young people within the Islamic world, I mean, I'm just thinking about the Palestinian Arabs. For generations, they have, you know, young Arabs in Gaza, in the disputed territories of Judea and Samaria called the West Bank. For generations, they have been indoctrinated with a lesson that their highest calling is to grow up to murder Jews and steal their land. They are told that, you know, they are the rightful heirs to the land, they are the indigenous people of the land. And it's all because, you know, this idea that if Muslims ever were in control of a territory, then that's theirs rightfully forever. It's all of that. So they're indoctrinated into this. And people in the West do not understand this. They do not understand that when it comes to, say, Gaza, you have a situation in which the Gazans are really oppressed by their Hamas rulers. They are jailed and imprisoned and tortured. If they're dissidents, they are starved. You know, during this war, Hamas has stolen much of the food for themselves, much of the aid, and has sold the rest on the black market at hugely inflated prices, which Gazans can't afford. Okay, so they hate, a lot of them hate Hamas, and that's now on the streets increasingly. But what people in the West can't get their heads around, even if they understand that they are demonstrating against Hamas, which they don't even know because the Western media won't tell them even that, but they can't understand that you can, if you're an Arab in Gaza, you may hate Hamas, but you will hate the Jews more, because all opinion polling has shown consistently that both in Gaza and in the so-called West Bank, the disputed territories of Judea and Samaria, the vast majority of Arabs, when polled, say that they support what happened on October 7. They would wish it to happen again. They want to see the Israelis killed. They want Israel destroyed. So, you know, you're dealing with a whole community which is signed up to the ideology of genocide and theft of another people's cultural identity in the land, and that's what, again, the West cannot understand, because it thinks of everybody in its own terms, like Mr. Witkoff.
Yeah.
You know, everybody can change. Well, people can change. But, you know, the reality of living in a totalitarian universe where it is simply not possible for you to think differently, because your parents and your teachers and the people who've taught your parents and their teachers, the people who taught them, have all said the same thing, which is hate Jews, kill them, steal their land, because it's ours of right, because we are Muslims. The average Westerner cannot get his or her head around that, because, like Mr. Witkoff, they insist on seeing everybody like themselves. You know, I, Steve Witkoff, changed in my 50s, so therefore, everybody can change in their 50s. Well, no, because you, Steve Witkoff, were not brought up to believe that you have a sacred duty to God to destroy the world for Islam. I mean, and he, you know, they just don't understand.
Yeah.
And it is an arrogance. It's a cultural arrogance.
Yeah.
Which is the West's undoing.
Yeah.